Good evening, everyone. Wonderful to see you again after I was away for a couple of weeks. Traveling and spending time with my family. So I was far away from all of this, and yet not at all. And yesterday I was made aware that it was the anniversary of the death of my Zumi Roshi, our great ancestor, the 30th anniversary of his death. And I remember where I was 30 years ago when we heard about this, and it was a long time ago. Yet at the same time, when I hear it's my Zumi Roshi's death, it's as if he's not really dead because he's alive and well right here with us. We are him. We are manifestations of this lineage, and we carry his teaching. We are his teaching. And he is the manifestation and of his teacher's teaching and all of the ancestors. So we are all the ancestors right here and now, something like that. There was, I'm not sure if I talked about this in Portugal or somewhere else, but we, in doing some studies with some other Genroshi's successors, we discovered that there was a missing ancestor in our lineage chart that we chant, and that those of you who have received Jukai, you fill in the lineage chart, and in the transmission documents, we fill in the lineage chart, and there's one missing on all of our papers. And it's when we discovered this, we checked around, and we discovered that it was also missing in Bernie Glassman's papers, in Genpo's successors, at least the few that we could contact immediately, and in several others. We did some research, and we found out from the president of the White Plum that actually, yes, at some point, this ancestor was reintegrated, was put back in the list. However, we don't know why he was left out and why he was put back. So Genroshi has reinstated this ancestor in her list. She put an insert in the sutra books, and the new list for people who do Jukai will have this ancestor in it. We haven't done any of this in our sangha, and I don't know what we'll do. I would like to know why he was left out and why he was put back in before I do anything. But my Dharma sister Betty, who was with us in Portugal, said to me, "Well, we say when we chant the lineage in the ceremony, we say, and to all the women ancestors and others whose names have been forgotten or left unsaid." So he's included, this guy. In our chanting. And he is all the other ancestors. He is us. We are him. So he hasn't been left out. Although I am curious to know why, so at some point, it's my Zumi Roshi who took him out, I think, because he's not on the documents of people who were his successors. So it's an odd thing. At the same time, he's there, we're there, we are the lineage, he is the lineage, etc. And this subject of the lineage also was very present for me in my personal family lineage because I was in the United States. Moving my mother from her house to another city, to a different living situation, and emptying her house with my sisters, going through all of her stuff that's accumulated there, boxes and boxes of letters and photographs and things that have been saved and documents and all kinds of things. And there's like 3 or 4 generations worth of letters and photographs that are there, including my parents saved all of the letters that I wrote to them when I, from the moment I first arrived in Europe, and the 4 years before when I was at university. So, I have like decades of letters that they saved, which is precious for me as a writer, to have that documentation, and also just as a person to see what I chose to write to my parents. This was in the days before telephoning was easy and before there was email. So in the mid-90s, the letters stop basically because then there was email and it was easier to telephone. However, there's, a good 20 years there of or more of letters. And then there's letters my mother wrote to her parents because her parents saved the letters, and then my mother saved the letters. And there's letters from my grandfather to his parents, just decades of things, generations of things. So these people are gone. No, my mother's not gone, but these people are gone. And yet they're alive, not only in those letters and in those photographs, but in me. I remember very strongly when my father died, I had this sense of he's with me forever. He is me in that sense. And even some of the things we found, some of the documents and dates and things we found didn't correspond with the stories that had been told in the family. Some of them. And so it makes it, it led us, my sister and I were wondering, well, what does that say about truth and fiction? And why would someone invent a story? Why, or is it just that their memory was different? Because we know memory plays tricks on us. It was just a mistaken date. Or it's some family legend that got passed down and it didn't really correspond to reality, but it's the story. And it's become a part of who we are. So all of these things were fascinating. And in terms of lineage and ancestry as well, because we have this personal lineage in our families. And in each family, there's n a number of lineages because you have two parents, and they had two parents, and they had two parents. And so there's these branching streams, right? And the same goes for our Zen lineage, which, yeah, I don't know how I could. So, I can say that I am the first. Geno Roshi is the first woman in her direct lineage to receive Dharma transmission. However, Maizumi Roshi gave transmission to a woman before her, but that's not her direct. She's descended from one of Genpo Roshi's disciples, who was a man. And before that, there were no women officially. However, so there's this greater lineage of all of Maizumi Roshi, and then Maizumi Roshi's brothers and sisters and his teachers, and so it's just this vast branching streams, tributaries, as we say. And yet we all are one. We are all the ancestor, and we can trace it all the way back to Buddha, we say, but then he also is not this isolated thing. He also is one with all the other ancestors. before and after. It's mind-blowing, actually, if we think of it. If you try to get your, as we say in English, if you try to get your head around it, you cannot. However, you experience it in every moment. Here and now, you are lineage. You are your family lineage. You are every ancestor that you can possibly trace your cells and DNA to. And as we know, we all trace back to, Lucy or whoever it was, and even beyond. It's endless. At the same time, we each are very particular manifestations right here now. And we know that in the Zen tradition, or even in our family traditions, we represent, we fill a very specific place in our family, which is part of who we are. I am the third child. Well, actually, I'm the fourth because there was a child before me who died. The third of, or the fourth of four or five children. My mother was the middle child. My father was an only child. All of these things are who I am, and we each hold those very specific places within our family units, within our greater family lineage. And in the Zen, our Zen lineage, it's the same thing. In Zen lineages, traditionally they have hierarchies. So the hierarchies are based on like the people who received Jukai, you're in order of your receiving Jukai. And so the people who received Jukai before others are considered more senior, or people who were ordained as monks. The one who first received was the first to receive the who ordained as a monk is then senior to those who received it more recently. And then they sit in the zendo according to that hierarchy of seniority. We don't do that. We don't have that hierarchy. We've in the Zen in the West, we've kind of moved away from that more or less. At the same time, we have it, I have to accept it that I am the first successor of my teacher. And so whenever there's anything where somebody has to go first, the others always make me do it. I mean, make me do it. That's my position, and I have to hold that position. I would prefer not to be the one to go first, but I have to honor that that's my place. It's not better or worse than the other places. It doesn't make me, exceptional because I am the first, or the guy who's the seventh is not exceptional. That's not it at all. It's just a different position. The same goes for our family lineages, for our, and then if we could, we can even say, we have lineages within our cities, within our workplaces, within our countries. You can say I'm descended from, well, I am descended from, the original invaders of North America. The people who came and first, took over the Indian land, the Native American land. My family has been in America since 1666, which is, a long, long time ago. So they were the first culprits. So that too is part of my lineage. I have to own that. That I am among these people who were the first ones to come in and say, we want this, we're going to stay here and we're going to do whatever we want here. I'm not proud of that particularly. No, I guess I could say there was great fortitude, bravery in these people crossing the Atlantic, leaving everything they had ever known, the old country, to go to the new country. because they were seeking freedom. They were persecuted. I guess I can see some honor in that. At the same time, I don't find a lot of honor in, you know, what that means they did when they arrived. So we can, you know, we can trace all these lineages that we belong to, and that we manifest, that we have in us, you know, and so we can question that. So I could question, okay, what is my attitude to Native Americans? What is my attitude to my country? You know, what is my attitude to people who don't look like me? Or, you know, maybe I have an affinity for people who are persecuted and who are refugees because that's in my blood, something like that, because my family was like that when they went to America. I don't know. The fact is, however, that we all of us on this screen, you know, we all are sharing something of our lineages, and we are all this lineage at the same time. And seeing all those objects and going through all these things of my mother's, that my mother has accumulated through, she has lived in this house for 25 years. After the death of my father, she moved to this house. So, but she dragged everything with her. We did an initial clear out when my father died, but not much. And there's emotional ties to things, and yet all of that, she is that too, you know. She is, she manifests everything, that all of the objects, all of the words, all of the moments that were lived in that house, and she takes it with her, even though she's given up a lot, and she feels that, and she has, you know, sadness about that. So when I was thinking about my Mizumi Roshi, and this notion of ancestors, we are the ancestor, we are my Mizumi Roshi. There's this koan that maybe it's kind of a story that's from Dogen. It's a koan, but he tells the story, Dogen, about Bodhidharma bringing together his four senior disciples, or possibly his only disciples. Not really clear how many disciples Bodhidharma had, probably not many. And in some stories, it says this takes place when he's about to go back to India. He originally came from India, and he was planning to make a voyage back to India. Some say it was when he was preparing to die. The fact is, he left China to go to India, and he never came back. So, probably died on the way or something like that. In any case, so he says to his students, I'm just going to read some of this. The time has come. Can you express your understanding? So one of the students, Dayufu, said, "My present view is that we should neither be attached to letters nor be apart from letters, and to allow the way to function freely." So this is really Bodhidharma's basic teaching. You know, it's a teaching outside of words and letters that has to do with the heart, strikes to the heart of each of us. Bodhidharma said, "You have attained my skin." So he approves of what his disciple has said. Another disciple, a nun, a woman, which is quite revolutionary, Nun Zongxi, said, "My view is that it is like the joy of seeing Akshobhya, Buddha's land, just once and not again." So this Akshobhya Buddha is, you know, an archetype of the land of pure joy or something like that. So she says it's like seeing that place just once and not again. So once is enough, right? Bodhidharma said, "You have attained my flesh." He totally recognizes, he acknowledges her. You retain my flesh. Another one, the next one said his name is Dayu, Daoyu. The four great elements are originally empty, and the five skandhas do not exist. Therefore, I see nothing to be attained. So this is emptiness, right? Nothing to attain, no one to attain it. This is vast emptiness, nothing holy. Another one of Bodhidharma's great teachings. Bodhidharma approves of it and says, "You have attained my bones." Finally, Weka, who came forward, he's the guy who cut off his arm in the snow. You've maybe heard that story. Who wanted his mind to be put at rest, at peace, can't find his mind, and Bodhidharma says, "I've put it at peace." So he comes forward, he makes a full bow, stands up, and returns to where he was. Bodhidharma said, he approves and says, "You have attained my marrow." So we have skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. Each one of them has attained it, right? After he says, "You have attained my marrow," to Ekka, he then transmitted the Dharma and robe to Ekka. Usually, when we hear this story, often you might see commentaries on this and things. People say there's a hierarchy, and the greatest realization was Ekka's, the marrow, and therefore he got the transmission. If we see it this way, we're missing what Bodhidharma is saying and what Bodhidharma is manifesting and what his disciples are manifesting. He could have said to the first one, "You have attained my marrow." He could have said to Ekka, "You attained my skin." If he had more disciples, he would have kept saying, "You've attained my mind, you've attained this, you've attained my hair, you've attained my eyes," whatever. You are it, my Dharma name. You are it, right? He's saying to them. At the time, the tradition was that a teacher could have only one disciple. He only had one robe. Actually, I only have one robe, but we all of us teachers have only one robe, but we allow our students to make a robe or we give them a robe, even though it's not our robe. It's the robe of the Buddha, no matter what. At the time, though, there was only one successor. And this goes on until the sixth patriarch. I think he's the last one who was, in fact, no, the fifth patriarch was. Gave transmission to several disciples. He's the first one to do it. So Bodhidharma, he could only give it to one. So he gives it to Ekka, who happens to be the last one to speak, who doesn't speak actually. But he's signaling to the others that they too have attained it. And they too can receive the robe and the Dharma and the transmission as well. I'm not sure, I'm not an expert. Maybe the other three went off and did that too. I don't know. Maybe Ekka gave transmission to one of them. I don't know. In any case, he's saying what I'm saying here, that we all are it. We all are the ancestor. We all maintain, and that's why when we receive the precepts, we say, "Will you really maintain it?" We say, "Will you maintain it?" Your vow. And the vow is all of those separate vows we make. It's really just the vow to realize the way that's true for you, to realize your life the way fully, the way of oneness and compassion fully. We take all those vows because that helps us. It breaks it down and helps us to have some reference points. Yet, you are already it, and you just need to realize that. That's all you need to realize. Without the reference points, it can be difficult. I know for my mother, part of the thing that I saw when I accompanied her from the city where she was living, took the airplane, went to the city where my sister lives, and I could see that this is difficult for her because all of her reference points now are gone. She's almost 97 years old, and She maintained her life as it was because it was all very routine. All the reference points were there, didn't have to think too much. But now things have been a bit destabilized, and it's going to take her a while to find her way again. So reference points are very helpful. At the same time, she is still completely wholly who she is, and wherever she is her home. It's hard to see that, however, when everything has been shaken up, taken away, moved, but wherever she is her home, actually, just like she is her ancestors. She is the way. We are the way. So this koan then has a poem, as koans often do, and it says, "Before a step is taken, you have already arrived. Before a word is spoken, the truth has been expressed." This is so beautiful. So we can even say, it's not that we don't have to do anything, but we are already doing it. The point is, we need to realize that. And realize that means to make it real. To make it real in our lives that we have arrived and that the truth has been expressed. We are arriving and the truth is being expressed. And before a step is taken, in that sense, we can also say the ancestors before us already did it. Before we've said a word, they said it. We can follow that example. We can say, oh, yes, that's it. They said it. That's what it is. How do I say it? My way of saying it is not their way. And you can see in our particular Zen lineage, the very profound teaching of that, because each person that embodies it, this teaching in our lineage, the teachers, are so different. They're all so different, and they say different things, different moments, different ways. They look different. They speak different languages. They walk different ways. They have different ages. They manifest it differently. And yet, it's all the same way. And they're manifesting what the ancestors manifested. And so, I'm speaking about my Zumi Roshi's death 30 years ago, honoring that, honoring him by speaking my own words, not speaking his words. He was quite revolutionary in the sense that his first disciple was Bernie Glassman, whose name was Tetsugen, and who did the whole thing. And he was, as I've said before, apparently he was not a very nice guy when he was at the Zen Center of Los Angeles. He was like super Zen warrior samurai, shaved head, robes, getting everybody to sit and do it right, and had a very deep, profound realization of the way, but that was the way that it was manifested in that time, because that's what my Zumi Roshi manifested. And then he left Bernie and completely, little by little, it didn't happen overnight, little by little, manifested his true manifestation, making it real in his way. He didn't grow his hair and his beard until after my Zumi Roshi died. However, and he still wore what do you call it, samware, the Zen monks wear when they're not wearing their robes, their casual wear. He still wore one of those kimono things, short kimono things. But when my Zumi Roshi died, grew his hair out, grew his beard out, wore Hawaiian shirts. And yet he was already doing what he was doing. And my Zumi Roshi was kind of like, what is this? What? He's starting a bakery? But he trusted. He like Bodhidharma, he said, "You have my skin, you have my flesh, you have my bones, you have my marrow. And now you do it. You are it, manifest it." And that's where we are today. That's what we're doing too. It would have been unthinkable for Maizumi Roshi to sit in front of a computer screen and give a Dharma talk. Completely unthinkable. It didn't exist in his day. But even so, I think he probably would have had difficulty coming around to that. He was of the school where there was a separate room, a separate hall where you gave Dharma talks. You didn't give Dharma talks just anywhere. And he had a traditional way of approaching it. And I'm sure he called the Dharma talks teishos, which is what the traditional word for it is, teisho. Some of my Dharma, at least one of my Dharma brothers, still calls it teisho. Call it a teisho if you want to. Call it a Dharma talk. Call it whatever you want to call it. It's still the same thing. So whether it's it's so I look at these notes I made on this koan. So somewhere I read that the first one, when he says, "You have my skin," he's actually saying it's referring to lanterns and standing pillars. So to the actual forms of things. When he says flesh, it's like saying this very mind is Buddha. When he says bones, it's saying mountains and rivers in this great earth. When he says marrow, it's like twirling a flower and blinking your eyes. There's all this stuff you can say about it, but each one comes back to the same thing. So, this very mind is Buddha, is pillars and lanterns, mountains and rivers, this great earth, twirling a flower, blinking eyes. It's all it. And this can be encouraging for us. This can be inspiring, especially in the world in which we live today. Which is disorienting, disturbing, disruptive to how we think things should be. And yet it's all a manifestation of it too. So that's just some of what I wanted to say. It just so happened that Maizumi Roshi's anniversary corresponds to my own process of looking into ancestry and personal ancestry and legacy and lineage and Zen legacy and lineage. So I'll stop there and allow you to speak if you'd like to, or question, or share, comment. Marek, hello.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you very much, Roshi, for saying those words about late Maizumi Roshi. I kept thinking about him these days and about this anniversary that is just happening. Probably because of the memorable encounters that I had with him. I had just twice attended the sessions led by him, but I remember those meetings vividly. One of the occasions was when Genpo Roshi received her transmission from Genpo Roshi. and Maizumi Roshi was present there. And before that was my second session I ever attended in Poland. And I had, it so happened that I came across a documentary made by Dutch Sangha a few years ago about Maizumi Roshi, and I thought that maybe perhaps many of you have never met Maizumi Roshi, and it's about an hour long documentary, and I don't know, is there here is a we have a chat here, if that's okay with you, I will put
yes, please, yeah,
the link into the chat box.
Yeah, thank you.
And I think it shows many dimensions of him, of Maizumi Roshi, also those that were somewhat controversial. So it's not only good things in it, but I think it's quite balanced, and I hope you will like it. So, and that's one thing. And the other thing is, I happened to attend a similar group like this, except that there is no teacher there. We are, oh, it's hosted by the a Zen woman whom I also met in the Netherlands, in Ameland. She is American, and she makes those meetings, and we thought about making a meeting for Maizumi Roshi, and perhaps it will be in the last Sunday of this month, so it's in more than 1 week. So I don't know if anybody of you would be interested in attending it. It's also in a on a Zoom platform. It will be on a Zoom platform. Since it's still like 10 days away, I think, and since I'm not quite sure today what day it will be, then maybe I can let everybody know. And also maybe if somebody who hasn't met Maizumi Roshi but who is inspired by the movie, maybe who he or she would like to share thoughts, so it would be great. Also you Roshi, you started your speech by saying, I remember what the day when Maizumi Roshi died and what I was doing. Maybe if you have the time and if you like, maybe it would be a good occasion to share it, or anything really that you guys feel appropriate for this occasion.
Okay. Thank you, Mark. Yeah, let us know when you know more.
Yeah, if I'm correct, it will be the last Sunday of this month. So in about 10 days. So if this is so, then maybe I will let you know. Maybe next Thursday or.
Okay. Yeah. Great. Thank you. And yes, I have seen this documentary. It's very, very good. Yeah. Thank you for sharing it. Wow.
Yes. Good evening, everyone. When you were talking about this this aspect of filling in a certain position, in the sense, as I understand it, owning the position, we are just filling a position. Whenever this issue comes up, I always, many times I remember, this is just a small story. I was a server during a retreat. It was in 2019 in the summer, João Sensei's transmission. I was a server. It was a big room, almost 100 people, I think. So there were a lot of servers, and at one point I was supposed to go. Each server would go to a specific, where they were numbered, specific places in the Zendo where each of us would go, and the head server would just say the number, so, and we would know where we were supposed to go. And there was this moment when I was supposed to go to the far end, because it was always moving, it was never the same for each meal, because there was a lot of people and there was always many changes. And this situation, usually there was a teacher there. It was Gena Roshi was in like this main, so facing the altar, and right across from her at the farther, the other end, there was always another teacher. And this, it was lunchtime, and it so happens that it was not a teacher who was sitting there. Actually, it was a small girl, someone's daughter, who was there. And actually, the teacher was to her left, and I was. It was not a very. It was not a very sophisticated thing for me, but for me, there was never a question. That's the place, and doesn't mind. Never mind that there's no teacher sitting there. That's where you go. That's where I'm supposed to go. But actually, then the head server told me that I should, just go to the teacher, which is on the side. And actually, that's what I did. That's what I did. And so I went, and I went to the teacher, and no. It's not about the, and he told me, very slow, slowly, low, but quietly, it's not about the person, it's about the position. So that was very, so yes, I was supposed to go to the little girl, as I had initially felt. It was very immediate for me, there was never any question. But then I just didn't do that because the head server said something else. So whenever that kind of issue comes up, I always remember this story. It's about the position, it's not about the person. I think there's something in that. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. And we can even see that the head server was also thinking of the position. So the teacher was the position in that case, not the place where the girl was sitting, and was saying that that's where you should go. So I don't think we could say the server was wrong or that the teacher was right. They were each just referring to a position in a way of seeing it in a different way, maybe.
Yeah, that's very good. Yes, thank you.
Eduardo.
Okay, just some comments, perhaps. I don't know if there will be a question anyway. I appreciate it, and I like it very much, this analogy or this connection you have made between the lineage in spiritual terms and, let's say, the genetical lineage. Of course, there are differences over there. You could say the first one is a spiritual lineage, the other one is more biological, or of course, with lots of other aspects, traditions, cultures, taboos, even secrets. And this analogy between these two kind of, let's say, distinct families, biological family and spiritual family, raises always the question, who am I? Where do I come from? Am I aware that I am not only me, that I am also my parents, great parents? Or if you are in a spiritual path, that I'm also embodying something from my teachers, from the lineage where I come from. Now, I guess that the interesting thing is that the biological one is just something that is there, whereas the spiritual implies some other level of acknowledgement. It doesn't mean that in the biological lineage you don't also acknowledge something, but this transmission issue that you have just mentioned, which is perhaps the most complicated thing to realize when we are in a spiritual path, what does that mean? What does that mean that you inherit a spiritual lineage, a spiritual tradition, a spiritual way of transmitting the Buddha's teachings? And how do you honor that? I mean, this is something that is, in fact, the great, perhaps, mystery and the great challenge for a spiritual path. How do you transform? How do you adapt the teachings? Acknowledging yourself that you are embodying all that past. I'm perhaps making the thing complicated, but the issue is this: what is exactly being transmitted? This is not only a formal way of doing things. I mean, we just had the Pope election, and even there, well, they'd really wanted to state that, after all, it's not only a human business, there is also the Holy Ghost, and it's perhaps this other spiritual dimension to acknowledge that something is being transmitted to a person. So, exactly, perhaps my question is this one. What, after all, is this core, this kernel of what is being transmitted that can be again transmitted to someone else, but that can be realized in so completely different ways? Does it make sense, the question?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's a really, essential common question that we all have. And the fact is that, you know, nothing is transmitted because it's all, we already have it. It's more a realization that each of us, you know, or have it is not even a good word, but it, we are it already. But it's more that the transmission is this heart to heart, mind to mind recognition of that, something like that. And even, you know, it's, I'm glad you brought up the question of the Pope, the issue of the Pope. I mean, I had completely forgotten it because so much has happened since then. But so this is a huge thing in the United States that there's an American Pope. I was there when this happened. This is just, I would never have expected it to be such a big deal. And particularly in Chicago, the city where he's from, my niece lives in Chicago. My daughter lived there for many years. My niece said she was walking down the street one, you know, the day that it was announced, and some lady just stopped her in the street and said, "The Pope, it's, you know, it's Robert, whatever his name is. He's from Chicago, the South Side, you know." Like, people in the street were stopping each other and talking about it, and they're like celebrations, and people who aren't even Catholic, you know. And yet, my sister-in-law, who's Peruvian, the same thing is happening in Peru. For them, he's Peruvian. He's completely Peruvian. And so, you know, some people are saying it's the second Latin American Pope. Some people are saying it's the first North American Pope. Some people are saying, well, it's the third Pope from the Americas. You know, his parents, his father was French, or of French ancestry, recent immigrant, his mother Spanish. So what is he? You know, who is he? He's only been a cardinal for 2 years, right? He was late, you know, coming to the, I think 2 years, right? Late, you know, he was one of the youngest. His brother, who was interviewed on American television, said he spoke to him the night before the conclave began, and his brother was watching the film Conclave. So the next Pope was watching the film Conclave because he'd never participated in a conclave, and he wanted to kind of have an idea of what, how it went, you know. This is like extraordinary. In any case, something, there's, you can see there's something in this man. I mean, you can with all the popes, probably. But, and I'm sure in Poland, you know, Mark can tell us, that was a big deal in Poland. You know, John Paul II was like, big deal. And it came with all that, at the same time as solidarity and all that, you know, it was a huge thing. So for the particular lineage of the Pope in his personal, who he, where he comes from, it's a big deal. It's really important. For his, he's like the first Augustine Pope, I think, right? So his particular spiritual lineage, he's the first one from that branch of Catholicism. And yet he's a real, he's inherited, he's a true successor in that sense of Francis, in his care for the poor and his dealings with the ordinary people in Peru. so where, who is he? You know, where do we place him? Clearly there's something in him that his fellow cardinals saw, and of course there's politics and there's stuff going on. 80% of the cardinals who voted were appointed by Francis, apparently. So, you know, there's a majority of people who are support Francis and will support what this way is. But this man, this new Pope, is Leo, as we say in English. In French, we say Léon. That too is kind of weird, but he's his own, he will manifest it in his way. And he already, you know, he's a tennis fan. I don't know if any of you saw this. He's a tennis fan. And he met with Yannick Sinner, who's the number one tennis player in the world, who's Italian. It's the Rome Open at the moment. You know, this also for the Italians, it's a big deal too. It's always a big deal for the Italians, I think. But so what does he manifest, you know? We would like to hope that he manifests the, you know, the heart of Jesus, of the very essence of what Jesus's teaching was. the compassion and the love aspect. Of course, you know, he has to deal with doctrine, he has to deal with dogma, he has to deal with tradition. There's a huge weight he's got to carry. And yet, just from what I've seen so far, he seems to be carrying it quite lightly. We'll see. I'm sure it's not going to be smooth going all the way. So that's another example. It's a good example, again, of lineage. And we carry all of these lineages in us. We are all these ancestors, and yet we manifest it in our way. And someone could, you know, the Peruvians say he's Peruvian. He is. He has Peruvian citizenship. The Chicagoans, oh man, no, he's a son of Chicago. He's a Chicago boy through and through. And I haven't actually heard him speak English, but he probably has a Chicago accent. He was from the south side of Chicago, which is, you know, that's like really hardcore Chicago. So who is he? Well, now he takes a different name. That's what's unique too. Theoretically, when we receive Jukai, we're supposed to take a different name too. And I should be called Tue Sola Roshi. Well, that doesn't really work for me. So, because we, who are we really? You know, what are we manifesting?
Yeah.
So, thank you for bringing that up. And I think we are out of time. Sorry if anyone wanted to say something else, but there did not seem to be a rush to speak. So thank you.